Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Off the Clock. It's the premium podcast where Jim and I talk about all the things that we're doing and saying and thinking and watching, touching, tasting, smelling off of official Bald Move podcast. We're going to be talking about Barry season three, the winning, the offer, and the closely related thematically, I think, Winning Time. Then we're going to talk about our thoughts on the Bold New Adventure, Strange New Worlds, the new Star Trek franchise. And I'm going to give my thoughts on Atlanta near and or rounding into its final few episodes. Jim, I feel like we've watched a lot of good stuff lately. There's just awash, mm-hmm. awash in television talent. Let's start with Barry. Are you current with Barry?
I am. Yeah, I watched the episode. I watched two episodes last night, including the latest one that came out that night.
I thought the latest episode was really funny. I enjoyed the operational security or lack thereof in NoHo's Chechenian drug unit. I liked the kind of the bomb tech support.
Yeah, I did. All the bomb stuff was incredibly funny. I loved it.
I saw some people seem to be, they thought that the tech support was too much, but what made it for me was when the lady says, oh, it sounds like you're all fixed because she hears the explode. And that's like such a tech support thing.
Dude, you know, like it's when the printer's Alec printing. Berg show. Like, what do you want? This is the guy who made Silicon Valley. This is the guy who, like, this is his sense of humor. If you're not in for that, I don't know how you made it this far in Barry.
Yeah, I thought that stuff is really, really funny. I thought that was the funniest episode we've had of the year. And they've been, none of them have been not funny. It's just, I thought everything kind of came together. I think the binds that they put people in this show are interesting. Because, like, Cousineau is faced with Barry, who I guess he could go and get the police after. Given him everything he's ever wanted, but it's all based on whether he accepts the lie.
Yeah, there's this delicate balance they're doing with Cousineau and Barry in this show that's like just walking the line of motivational believability with these characters. Like, okay, yeah. I buy that he doesn't want Barry to kill his family, and so he's going to go along with this acting thing, and I buy that, like, once Barry says, and that could turn around into now where, like, Barry's not threatening his family anymore, but Cousineau still wouldn't go to the cops to have Barry arrested, and like he's not forgiven him for killing his girlfriend or whoever that was, but like also he's not going to bring up charges or anything. I don't know. It's this delicate dance they've been doing for a long time with Barry, and this season feels like it's just, boy, that tightrope is getting thinner and thinner as Barry tries to walk across it, and I feel like it's working.
Yeah, no, I do. Cecily's kind of checked out on this show. She's like, I don't know if I really like this anymore. I've been background watching it for more and more, and she's decided, like, as of the last episode, she's like, I don't want to watch this anymore. And she cited that, like, it's increasingly hard for her to stay attached to the Barry character. But I've felt like they've done a very good job of contrasting, like, Barry and whether he's sympathetic, and NoHo Hank is sympathetic, and his boyfriend's sympathetic, and the only person that's like I truly feel sorted about just being an awful person is Fuchs.
Sure.
Like, he's not just a bad person. He's also someone that makes the people around him worse. He's talentless, compassionateless, has no imagination except when it's being devious and a fuck.
Mm-hmm. He's vengeful. He's petty. He's he's just an all around bad
incompetent
person.
He's just a terrible, terrible person.
Here's the thing. I understand the sentiment of, like, losing interest in this. I think they are doing a bit of chasing their own tail with Barry. Like, he is kind of going through these cycles over and over and over again, and I don't see any real progress. And every time you think he's about to make progress, the shit, like, happened with Sally in this latest episode happens, right? Where she, has had some epiphany about their relationship and decides to call it off, and now Barry's right back into that dark place, right? the show has done that multiple times, and I see why that could get tiring for some people, but she finished Ozark. I feel like that should be.
It's interesting, you know? Because like this reminds me a lot of BoJack Horseman, if BoJack was also hunted by international assassins. Like, he's going through these things of, like, you know, intense revelations about his mental and emotional capacity and his trauma and his unpacking and his I guess where BoJack had the addiction, Barry's got the, you know, no shit paramilitary operators on his ass every once in a while. And how Fuchs has maliciously stirred up every one of Barry's victims with this one-sided retelling of what and is and getting children, like he's recruiting child soldiers to get revenge on Barry. I hate him so much.
It's a shitstorm coming for Barry.
Kenneth Goulet.
How many seasons do you think this show has left in it? Because I'm thinking they might want to end it here in season three, or maybe one more. Maybe.
It's tough to say because, I mean, I don't want to get into the Better Call Saul trap where it's like I had in mind like what this show could be, and then I started seeing everything as like stalling and delaying rather than this is the natural. I don't know if that maybe I fell into that a little bit too much, so I'm going to try not to, Barry. But I agree with you. I don't know how much, but I also think that like as long as they can keep the stakes of Barry plausibly escalating, and I feel like they've done that through pretty creative ways, like flipping, you know, adding an entire new faction to the conflict of last season to now Fuchs, or you know, like turning against him and organizing this army of civilians against him. Like they keep coming up with these credible, interesting perils for Barry. And they keep, you know, finding ways to like pull the rug out from under his feet, and not in just like a like it's not just dramatically interesting. The what's going on between is it Shelley? What the hell is this?
Sally
and Barry. But thematically, it's interesting too that like, you know, this young actor who sees Sally as a mentor can accurately call out like Barry's like anger and the inappropriate way he talks to her. Yet everyone is blind to the way that Sally treats her poor fucking assistant.
Yeah.
You know, and how kind of like awful that she is. And like, not just like on a bad moment, but just day to day, moment to moment. She's terrible to this woman. Whereas Barry, it's like, but like on the balance, I agree with the show, like with her assessment that Barry is a psychopath. But like, I feel bad about, you know, like a person that was yelling at somebody, but not like throwing things or breaking things. Like, cause you don't fucking know. Like if you're a Bald Move fan and you're at the Denver airport, and you saw me and Jim having an argument in a concourse. And I'm like, you fucking stupid son of a bitch. I'm going to ruin you. And I stormed off. Right. You might think, Jesus Christ, Aaron's got an anger problem. But if you'd have found out that just before Jim said, hey, I cleared out the Bald Move bank account, I'm going to Tijuana, a non-extradition state, and you'll never see me again, you fat fuck. Then you might be like, you know what? That was in. And like, I was thinking, like, if Barry was honest in his relationship with Sally, then I think his anger in that moment was justified. Because if he's like, you know, I actually have people on my ass, I'm trying to keep myself out of jail, and you're cool with my professional killing, and she was being that like extra about her job over his very life and death situation. But the reality is she's, you know, like Barry just seems like he's weirdly insistent about this thing happening this one day. And he's calling on the fact that he's probably made more sacrifices for her than vice versa. I don't know. I think it's interesting the juxtaposition of like, what does it mean to be violent? What does it mean for someone to be a terrible person? How are the different ways we can be terrible and hypocritical to each other? I really like that exploration. So I think as long as they can keep doing that and being funny. Yeah, I don't know. You're feeling this.
I am feeling the cycles that the show is continuing to go through. They change it up a little bit every time, right? Like the latest cycle of Barry's violence or psychopathy, whatever, is at his own doing. Right. You know, like before it was always Fuchs pushing him into something, right? That Barry didn't want to get involved with. This time he's going out to Cousineau's house and telling him, I'm going to kill your whole family if you don't come with me on this acting gig. That's right. All Barry.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit different, but also I'm definitely starting to lose sympathy for Barry as he acts more on his own accord.
I think you're supposed, this is like a Walter White situation. You're supposed to.
Yeah.
Cause you're right. Like Barry is the only way for Barry to get good at this point is to like do jail time. Like literally, and he mm-hmm. might not ever get out of prison as many people as he's killed. But it's like, when you say it's like, well, it's Barry's own design, but like, that's like judging a rat when they're halfway through the maze. Like, well, you're here and you don't have a map and you don't know which way to go, but what, just know I'm judging every future step. Like, he was put in this crazy position. That's why it's like Fuchs is the one person who's truly evil.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, Breaking Bad cancer is the evil, ultimate evil in that universe. But
sure.
Fuchs took a person, because the other thing about the scene of him yelling at Sally is he's also canonically a vet with PTSD.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't make it okay to verbally abuse your partner, but no. it's something that someone could add to the picture that they're seeing before him and be like, oh, I can understand why she might let something like that slide if such and such. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah, all the stuff with Sally's show is not really doing it for me. Like, I understand the behind-the-scenes stuff they're doing with her and Barry. Like, that part is pretty interesting, but like, I'm not sure why I care about this award. I'm not sure why I care about any of the stuff that's happening that isn't directly related to like domestic violence or their relationship itself.
I think they're just exploring, it's like, I don't know, it feels like they're exploring like Hollywood, some kind of Hollywood hypocrisy, or maybe they're going to go into like, what did you think of her reaction to getting 98% on Rotten Tomatoes? Because to me, it felt like a person who is about to have their fraud complex kick up to a million.
I suppose so. I mean, a lot of this is just played for comedy, right? Like, it's that scene is definitely a lot of comedy. But the stuff with like the interviews, that's all just, hey, we need to make this part of the show funny. So let's have her sit down with 15 different interviewers in the same amount of seconds and. I don't know. It wasn't anything interesting, or it didn't really feel like it had anything to say other than stuff I've already heard before. So I don't know.
Is Sally from Joplin? Because like I forget.
It's her real story.
I forget from. Well, we know it's also great. It's been fabricated, fictionalized, and spun like a lot from even its like already kind of fabulized version that she was performing in Cousineau's class. So I wonder, I'm not going to go back and, cause this is off the clock, man. Fuck that. Going back and rewatching all of Barry up to this point.
No.
But like, I'm wondering if she's also like some of this fraud complex might be realer than some of the ones that others, you know, that we might realize we've lived in. Cause like if I, you know, had started like, I don't know, I'd feel like a pretty big fraud if it turned out that like I wasn't from a cornfield in Indiana and I wasn't in a religious cult and I didn't lose all my friends. Like if people found that out at this point, it would probably be detrimental to my career even worse than had I just never. So like,
don't worry, point I'll that keep she your secret.
Thank God. We're in a pact.
Secret dies with me. Yeah.
We're in a pact, man. But do you know, like, to the extent that some of this is made up and that the sense that she isn't living up to her ideals 100% in terms of being, you know, a girl boss, I wonder, like, yeah, you're fraud. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Fraud complex times to a million if there's actually a hint of truth to it.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Maybe I can reinvest in that side of it.
But you're not. But I don't know. If it's not grabbing you, it's not grabbing you.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the signature hilarious Barry episode, though. This was funny.
I felt like this was it. To me, all the bomb stuff that ran through this entire episode was just. Yeah, I found myself like when he's crawling under the crawl space and the thing is like talking in French. And
do you know what it was saying?
I don't, and I think it's almost better that way, but like, yeah, tell me what it was saying.
In Korean, it was saying, you have picked up a bomb. And then when he bumped it on that rafter, it switched to Japanese saying, "You have picked up a bomb."
I just thought it was hilarious, man. Like, he's got cardboard box. Yeah.
And I want to break down, just to go ahead, but I want to break down why this is funny.
I mean, to me, it's hilarious because it continues to escalate in, like, the urgency of getting rid of this bomb. To me, it's almost like a Pink Panther type skit where he's running around with this big stupid bomb, like a Batman and Robin kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if Batman and Robin had done that for like half the movie and had just been running around with this bomb that keeps talking to them and getting more and more urgent that they get rid of it.
Having tech support issue. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was great.
I think it's funny because, like, it presupposes this criminal underworld where there's commodities you can get, like explosives and...
Sure.
But usually when fictional universes delve into that, it's like John Wick style, where everyone's got gold for the currency and Lance Riddick wearing a three-piece suit is going to usher you to your weapons room and everything is, like, top of the line. But, like, in reality, any kind of gray market...
Yeah.
Murder is going to be second rate and shitty and using these unreliable software. But then the three-step comedy to that is also actually this shitty company has a very competent tech support team.
Yeah.
I think all of that together.
This is Alec Berg crossing his love of technology with the underworld. And
yeah.
And just like his particular view of modern technology and where we're at right now. And you can see it all over Silicon Valley, but he's bringing that into the show. And I thought it was perfect.
Yeah.
And then there's his other bit. And I don't know how much of this is, you know, Bill Hader versus Alec Berg and all that. But like, I could see the DNA in those scenes when fucking Cristobal is trying to like tell his boss, hey, maybe just take these guys to lunch, right? It's this like this mundanity, this everyday kind of, oh, what would you do if you were trying to smooth over a problem in the office, you know?
Yeah.
You'd tell your guys, okay, you'd have this like big team meeting at lunch and you'd have them get them all feeling good. And then you drop the bombshell on them. Hey, we're going back to Bolivia. And to do that with guys who are actively strapping up to go murder a bunch of people, the juxtaposition of that is just hilarious.
I wonder what they're doing with this Bolivia stuff, because is this going to be like the old lady to swallow the fly, where it's like they keep on... Yeah. The central problem is the lady swallowed the fly. You can put spiders and frogs and tame lions. But the problem, you know, like, but you're just making the problem worse and worse and worse every iteration.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's going to now that they wipe out Bolivia, like the entire contingent, what is going to be the response from Bolivia now that they're going to do to Chechnya? Yeah. Like especially since at what point does Cristobal see that he keeps on being the loser in these exchanges? Because they even talked about in the beginning, like, it's like, oh, both of our guys are wiped out. Well, my guys are wiped out a little bit more than your guys, kind of. And now, yeah, like, does his wife come with a whole bunch of Bolivian death squads now? Like,
yeah, maybe.
It's early goings in the seasons for this much climax, man.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think the joke's going to be that the bomb was like super wimpy and it didn't like hard, it didn't kill the old man?
I mean, it looked pretty strong, pretty powerful bomb.
I mean, even Cristobal, whose back was half out the door, like he was running out even he got pretty singed.
Yeah, Barry's car got damaged.
I love everyone interacting with Gene Cosano in this episode because like everyone, he's acting bizarre, like he's trying to reject success. Mm-hmm. And everyone treats it like it's classic Gene. Like when he's meeting with his agent, who I think his name's Fred Melamed. This guy is so funny in Lady Dynamite. But the litany of the things that they say, like when he's like, and like when he gets a fuck, and that's the one that registers with Gene. He's like, who called me a fuck? My favorite one was the stone, like this especially in line of our recent podcast on Killjoy, but Stone Cold Buster.
Oh yeah, yeah.
God, that was my favorite one.
Good stuff. I'm enjoying it.
I mean, so the other thing is, like, Barry, it's got to be significant that NoHo Hank puts in all this detonate shit on his app. He puts his face, he puts his real home address, his phone number, credit card. He's like, that's going to pay off, right?
Probably. I mean, it could have just been, you know, one of those Berg flourishes that is like, every app requires this of you, and go ahead and do it on your stupid detonate app. But maybe, probably, I hope.
I was trying to figure out, because like, I'd almost felt like NoHo Hank was setting up Barry, which he might be, because there's always like he's always been kind of backstabby. I don't think he has much in the way of principle. It's all about what's going to be good for NoHo.
Yeah, sure.
Did I tell you I looked up the address that they were gandering on, and it's attached, as far as I can tell, a real company called NoHo Apartments that does like exotic pet apartment rental. And you can call them. It's a real business. I got their answering machine. But like, why are they using this real place that's got NoHo in its title? Because they have to know that hundreds, if not thousands, of people are going to be calling that place, harassing them the next day.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Asking for Barry, if Barry lives there. Do you think the address is... Because I noticed there's a little bit of division in the internet between people who think that that's Barry's address and that's Sally's address. That Fuchs is going to put out a hit on Sally to get revenge.
Oh, wow. I didn't think about that. Could be.
And I'm face blind when it comes to these locations. I couldn't tell you. If you showed me Sally, Barry, and Jean's house, I wouldn't be able to pick them out of a lineup. No way.
Me either.
Anything else we want to talk about with Barry before we put it away for a couple weeks?
I don't think so. I'm good.
All right, let's move on to the offer. I don't even have to ask if you enjoyed it, because you watched all fucking five episodes. And I wanted to. I just ran out of steam last night. I was like midnight, and I'm like, I'm not starting off this week with a sleep deficit. I love this show.
Yeah. I started off, I watched the first few scenes, and I was like, I don't know if this is going to be the right tone or good enough. This is going to be too networky. And by the time I got through that first episode, I was hooked. Yeah, I think it's smart of them to get to Francis Ford Coppola, get him in the picture before the end of that first episode, because that's what everybody wants to see, right? Is like, how does he intersect with this?
The professor from Walking Dead is nailing Francis Ford Coppola so hard. Him and Mario Puzo.
He's great, yeah.
Their love affair is, and that, you know, let me ask you this. How much do you care about how much historicity this show has?
I don't care. What I'm doing is I'm saying none of this is real. Because if you look at what this is the recollections of Albert Ruddy, who was a producer, the producer on The Godfather.
The producer, yep.
It's his recollections as filtered through a book that he wrote that is currently in its marketing cycle. Mm-hmm. So you need to say, like, you take everything with a grain of salt. Like, this is a man who is portrayed in the show as a liar, a cheat, whatever. He will do absolutely anything it takes to meet his ends.
Yeah.
And with maybe the exception of like helping the mob kill somebody, I don't know, or sanctioning that.
Maybe.
But take this with a huge grain of salt, because he's portrayed as a liar in the show. He lies all the time. He's got a book out that he's currently promoting. I don't believe a single word of this, but it's fascinating and it's a fun watch.
That's, and usually, because I get pretty bent out of shape when I watch something and I'm thinking, this is amazing. And then I find out it's all been fabricated and it's based on a historical event. But I feel like that if you're writing meta shit about Hollywood, like that's a lot different than if you're taking an autobiographical look at someone's life, or you're looking at a real historical event and you're trying to tell the audience they should feel a certain way. And you're, you know, like, I don't like who the stakes here are, like, someone's getting more or less credit for the creation of arguably the best movie of all time. Yeah. Pretty low. And I feel the same way about The Winning Time, which we're going to talk about next, because I feel like they're so closely related. Like, if you want to lie, don't lie to me about some battle in World War II. Lie to me about how the 1980s championship for the NBA was won. Because, like, who cares? Who cares? You know, that's not going to affect the way I vote, the way I live my life. But it might affect the way I'm entertained. And I found both of these stories, which are so similar in structure so far, you know, we're not through to the offer. That, like, I'm like, you know what, even if this isn't, and if this is essentially mostly true or partially true or total fabrication, I'm so entertained, I don't even care.
Yeah. I'm with you there. I'm really enjoying the show. I don't care if it's fabricated, but I think the broad strokes, based on everything I've heard from other sources, the broad strokes are roughly true in this, right? Like, the mob was sort of involved. Frank Sinatra was kind of a dick about the whole thing. I don't know that he's, like, sending warnings and shit. I don't know if that part is real, the details. Right. But the broad strokes, I think, are real.
I think because that's what I also felt about Winning Time. It's like, from my vague recollections of being a young basketball fan and being really into the Magic Johnson versus Larry Bird rivalry and all that kind of stuff, like, there's enough truth here that, like, I know it's not a total fabrication. Because we've done a fair bit of research into The Godfather and how it was written. And I'm looking forward to, like, there's got to be a scene of George Lucas coming in and saving the day with some edits and, like, you know, like, hit these, because I know a lot more about the actual production. This pre-production shit was fascinating, but I just be like, you know, did this guy really make Hogan's Heroes? Did this guy? And a lot of it does seem true, and it's just, I don't know, like, it's just a lot of fun. Like, the casting, this kid that they got playing Al Pacino.
Oh, yeah, like, dude.
And I feel like the same way about the guy that plays Magic Johnson in Winning Time. Like, if you just look at him, like, sitting there, you might not see it. But when they start with the accent or the smile or this kid's eyes.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy shit, that's young Al Pacino.
I was super impressed by him. I'm also super impressed by the guy that got to play Marlon Brando.
Oh my God.
If you told me this was Marlon Brando somehow, I would almost believe you, because he is
especially
so good.
Once he went to Shoe Black and the Kleenex. Because, like, I've always heard that story as, like, this is kind of, you know, like, oh, this guy mumbling through his cotton wads or whatever. But, like, and it also gives you appreciation of, like, you know, why are some actors considered great?
Yeah,
it's because they put so much thought into it. Like, it's not just the stuff they do and it's not crying on demand, but it's like crafting a character. And I don't know that Pacino still does that. I felt like that part of him broke around Mad Dog and Glory or whatever.
Sure.
But back then when he was a theater kid, like, I forget, in episode 4, there was this thing where he sat down with Coppola and they're talking about the character, the scene, and, like, he just nailed something really essential about the character of Michael and the alchemy of what
he's stuck, torn between those two worlds, right? There's something in him that does want that life, even though he
wants
out of
to prove himself to his dad, and, like, you know, but, like, yeah. And, like, you really get that kind of alchemy between a director and the writer and the actors. And also, for the first time in my fucking life, I'm starting to understand what a good producer does.
Right. Makes, like, all the pieces fit together, right?
A good producer is essentially a fixer. That, like, the direct, like, I have to get this person as much stuff as he needs. And there's also got to be an understanding that you can't get everything, Francis.
Right.
Like, I think that happened in 4th episode, too, where Francis started whining that he's going to have to take James Caan, which is... It's still pretty funny that, like, one of the
Now tell me an executive producer does.
So I think he's the guy that's above the producer, and he says he's all about artistic merit, but when his balls are being squeezed by the owner of the Austrian owner of the film production, he then just fire and brimstones everybody until they spend less money. I think that's what you do if you're that guy.
The other guy I'm you haven't seen the 5th episode?
I have not.
Okay. They introduce James Caan in the 5th episode. Not as impressed with the actor they got for that. Ooh. As far as his looks, I think he brings the right fire to the role and the right personality. The looks are not as good as, like, Pacino or Brando.
Interesting. Khan's got a very distinctive manner about him too. I'm curious to see that. Do you think it's going to be a one season and done? Like, is it going to go all the way up?
I think it's called
through
a limited series. So,
okay,
yeah,
good. Probably. Good.
Although I would love to see, I don't know if there's as big a story on like The Godfather 2 making of, right? Because it was an established thing and they just kind of probably made it. But like,
it would be interesting to do all three of The Godfathers because they were all made for very different reasons.
Godfather 3 would probably be an interesting story. Why wasn't that nearly as good as the other two?
I liked Coppola's point of view. He's like, oh man, like I thought this is going to be the one I made for them, but it's going to be the one I make for me. And
yeah,
I love like this. Then this organically discovering things about like, oh, we need to put a scene about Italians fighting about making salt. And also like, the other thing a good producer is like, they're like a captain, a coach, all these different things while yet always deferring to like the creative types. Cause I thought that scene, of Mario Puzo saying like, I'm going to write this script in 3 days. And I remember thinking like, I don't think that's how this happened, but maybe it is all a ball of fire. And,
and then you see him floating there with a big cold
pasta on his belly. Yeah. And he's saying like, I'm a fraud. I'm going to destroy this thing. And the producer guy, like kind of having to work him through that writer's block, that first step of like, how do you break down the scene? Here's a basic motivation. Go like, I'm having so much fun with it.
The other guy, very impressed by, Keeley from
Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso show is in this. Yeah.
With an American accent like this, they're taking over, Jim. I don't know if you've noticed the Australians.
That's fine. I'm okay with that.
The New Zealanders, the UKians, they're taking over. Like there are not going to be any more jobs for Americans left.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
gotta tighten up the border.
Can't make jokes about that. Yeah. So she's great. I love her. And she's a lot of fun in this show, but also,
yeah,
Giovanni Ribisi playing Joe Colombo.
God. Oh my God.
He's great, right? Like him, this role is very akin to like Colin Farrell and the Batman, his penguin.
Yeah. It's not quite because he's definitely recognizably Giovanni Ribisi, but I know what you mean about those first couple scenes because they're also doing this can be annoying thing of like, oh, look at everything good in The Godfather came from these real life. And this guy's essentially doing The Godfather through a ton of that episode.
Yeah.
But so he started in a kind of a hole for me, but like what he really won me over when he came down for the script reading.
Yep.
And he can't even make it like three lines of reading for. He's like, you know what?
He reads the title page, right?
Fade in is what like that's. And he's like, he actually, I'm like, oh my God, this guy seems like such a wise guy who has been kind of like somehow hoisted on his own petard. No, like he's the guy's great. Giving him everything he wants, but now he's like running up against his basic incuriosity. And you know, lack of
he doesn't really care about this, right? Like this was all Sinatra and all like part of his American or his Italian American,
right?
Whatever it is,
but suddenly insanely invested because he's like, I ain't gonna let this jumped up singer and some fucking New York councilman gonna go. And now he's like got skin in the game and he's pushing this guy and he's personally invested in the movie being a hit because.
Yeah.
Now his reputation with the family is all tied up into it.
Oh my God. Episode five, man.
Episode five
flips everything.
I remember hearing that the mafia getting involved in the shooting process turned out to be, and like they also tried to do kind of like some Goodfellas stuff where like they're making money coming and go. So
yeah, there's a little bit of that.
Yeah.
This is
way better than I expected. And I was expecting it to be pretty odd. By the way, this is on Paramount Plus. If you're wondering like what the fuck is this, where do you get it, it's one of the only reasons I can think of that are must try out 7-day trial on this thing because it's amazing. Oh, how about Bern Gorman?
Yeah, as the owner of
Charles Bluedorn or what, this Austrian guy, like this guy's a fucking character actor.
Oh yeah,
he's the Fuken legend of Gin Alley. He's the swaggering
mercenary they send over to Illis to try and take that back from the Belters.
The corrupt sheriff of this alien frontier
in the Expanse.
He's this nerdy scientist jacking in the brains on Pacific Rim, and he's this crazy lustful like Roger Sterling Austrian edition guy in this. Like, it's insane. The physical transformation, the accent, the effect.
Yeah. So he owns what? Gulf and Western, which owns Paramount?
Yes.
The chain of custody there? Okay.
Yeah.
So he's like at the very, very top of that ladder. He's the CEO of the holding company that owns.
Yeah. He fires everyone in the show at his pleasure. Yeah. And but the Colin Hanks is such a fucking asshole.
Oh God. Like, and the reason he's an asshole is because we know this movie becomes like
he's trying to kill the Godfather.
Right. He's trying to kill one of the most beloved movies ever made. So like,
yeah.
But there's a lot of reason, like, if you didn't know that, to be on his side, right?
No,
because it's kind of a shit show. It's run by a producer who's like a first time kind of producer.
Never made a movie. Some up jump guy from Rand that this one coked up executive is kind of taking a swing on, and that's right. All the ego that gets built up into this stuff too.
Yeah, that's what
like,
I love.
Like it does show like a particular maniacal type of person that makes this kind of stuff happen.
Yeah. I really love the stuff around Al Ruddy where he's just like got to devote his life to this. There is no time or room for anything else. And everything else gets crowded out because he loves this. This is his passion.
Matthew Good, who was Ozymandias from The Watchmen, is the Bob Evans guy.
Oh, he's fantastic, man.
He's really good. He's really good. And like, he's also so good at playing politics. Like that one thing I thought, like, you just completely roll over for Tom Hanks. And he gives a guy a lesson about, well, you got to learn how. And then he goes and just completely destroys Colin Hanks in his own office. And tells him how it is. Like, I don't know, man. I'm fascinated by this material. I'm fascinated by the casting, the performances. The script crackles like it's just how many episodes is it supposed to be? Okay, 10 episodes. Cool. So they'll probably get all the way through this. I don't know any of the people directing I guess Adam Arkin directed the last two, but I don't know any of these people writing and working on as a show creator on this stuff. Michael Tolkien.
Yeah. That's why, you know, I kind of didn't want to give this thing the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's why it started rough for me, because Paramount is not a studio that I have a ton of respect for when it comes to television.
Well, the first couple episodes, I started thinking that they were baiting and switching me. It's like everyone loves The Godfather and this is going to be more of an anthology about four or five different things being greenlit at the big Paramount properties. And them kind of rope-a-doping you. But like, no, it definitely just centers on The Godfather, which is... But yeah, it felt like something that Paramount was just shoveling out there to take advantage of. Like, what's our biggest property outside of Star Trek, you know?
Right. And I was worried that it would feel like a network television show, that this would feel like a CBS, you know, whatever. This feels more like prestige than a network television show. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's worth, I mean, it's Paramount is not exactly, like I said, they don't have a lot of things on there. It's like Halo, which isn't getting great reviews, and Star Trek, which hasn't gotten
all
great reviews,
although
we're about to talk about that. But I think it's kind of worth it for the 7-day trial when this thing gets out, because it's been 4 episodes through. It's a hoot. I can't wait to watch the next episode tonight.
Yeah, so you mentioned like structurally this is very similar to Winning Time. Let's talk about Winning Time, because it's an era of basketball that's like right before my time, and I'm interested how structurally it's similar to this.
So that's what I'm saying, like it was right at my, like I was into basketball, and to the extent that I loved watching my big extended family get together and watch IU basketball at my granddad's house. So I liked the sport. I lived in Indiana, so we had every fucking house in the neighborhood had a basketball court. And I had that experience of being a little kid and pretending that I was going one-on-one versus. And at that era, the two big guys were Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Me and my cousin played so many matches of Larry Bird versus Dr. J, which later became Larry Bird versus Magic Johnson. And it's just really, so like I got the dim awareness, and then like also been a big Bill Simmons fan. He's a big Boston fan. I know about Red Auerbach, whatever the guy's name, the kind of maniacal owner of the Reds or the Celtics, and Jerry Buss being kind of like the free-willing, very popular, spendy owner of the LA Lakers. But it is exactly like, just in the same way that The Offer is a kind of gossipy historical retelling of a bunch of unique personalities coming together to make this amazing thing. Winning Time is about this freewheeling kind of like spindy but eccentric, brilliant guy who decides to buy the Lakers on kind of a whim as basketball is at its lowest popularity, as like, you know, black players and like it becoming more urban and turning off middle America. It's like like everyone's selling on NBA, and he's like, I actually see something instead of like pushing these elements away, embracing it, embracing what's cool and what's hip, and, you know, getting this basketball game out of the like the old era of fundamentals and going more of dunks and flashy stuff. And you've got this draft where Larry Bird, Magic Johnson is up on the block. And just like the Offer, like the casting, like John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss is just so fucking inspired. And he's so much of a fun guy to just kind of watch, like a Hugh Hefner guy. It's kind of like slosh, you know, just like, you know, banging girls way too young for him and doing drugs and alcohol and doing these deals and winning over the much more established, more traditional guys and screw it. And then there's like a bunch of real pathos with him and Sally Fields with his mom, and ends up getting cancer, and he's got this relationship with his daughter, and the basketball stuff is brilliant. Like, do you know who Pat Riley is?
Sure. Coach of the Lakers. Yeah.
He is portrayed by Adrian Brody in the era of like between him being a Lakers player and like before he became one of their head coaches. Yeah. And he's just so rock solid as Pat Riley. Every once in a while they do this thing, because at this point he's got like shoulder length hair and like a mustache, and he's wearing like 70s clothes. Right,
that's not the Pat Riley I know.
Every once in a while, so this show breaks the fourth wall all the time. But every once in a while, like when Pat Riley starts doing Riles stuff, they'll do like a subliminal photo if it could be the real Pat Riley. Because on my image of Pat Riley, what's your image of Pat Riley?
It's the slick back hair guy in a suit.
That's Gordon Gekko.
Essentially, on the side of the
and like every once in a while you'll get a scene of like, I think it might be Adrian, is like, it's in black and white, and he's like looking at you, and his hair's slick back. He's in a shark skin suit, and he's like staring right at you. And I'm like, oh, but yeah, like the guy that they got playing Larry Bird, he plays him with the energy of like a homeless drifter serial killer. Like how maniacal that him and Larry Johnson and Magic Johnson just wanted to kind of kill each other. There's this anecdote in one book I read where Larry Bird is talking about after one of these finals games where the Celtics closed them out, that he sees the bus, the LA Lakers about to leave in the airport, and he sees Magic Johnson sitting in like a middle row against the glass, and he kind of like his head kind of drops and his head like he's in defeat, and his head kind of lolls against the glass, and he's like shaking his head, and Bird says, my first thought was suffer, like, you know, because like we've since become friends and blah blah blah, but like I wanted to beat this man and break him and like take every, and they just really bring that kind of like passion. There's like all kinds of like, because Magic Johnson is a rookie and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the captain of the team, and they have a really cool big brother, little brother relationship. The show is hysterical. They got this Jerry West, who famously hates losing and had a rough transition as from player to coach to general manager, almost has PTSD from losing to the Boston Celtics. they play him like a crazy man. And the real life Jerry West is suing this over the portrayal of him being this maniacal guy who can't. And it, like, there's something kind of fucking like the Jerry West as depicted in the show would absolutely sue HBO for historical inaccuracies about the way he's being depicted. It's just,
can they use that as evidence to say we're accurately depicting
him? I don't know. But it's a self-contained story. It's all of that season where they win the 1980s championship, and it's just really it's a good time watching it.
I wish when people talked about this, they would make it clear that this is a docudrama. Like this is not a documentary, like the Michael Jordan thing that was on HBO not too long ago, because that's what I was thinking. I'm like, I was interested in the Jordan stuff because I was a big fan of basketball then. Mm-hmm. But if this is like a scripted drama kind of thing, I'm way more interested in that.
It is The Offer, except for what they're building is a championship basketball team, not the best movie of all time. Like, I was stunned at the parallels of like, yeah, just like even the pieces that don't seem like they're working, if you get them with the other right pieces, everything starts to fire, and there's probably going to be some demons, you know, that are explored in the head. Like,
It's one thing to find like a Marlon Brando lookalike, because I don't know, Marlon Brando's not 7'1". How do they handle that when they have to find like 15 different basketball players who are not?
I wondered about that, because the guys they got to play Kareem and Magic are incredible, and Kareem's 7-foot-tall, and these guys all look very tall, and I don't know whether doing Lord of the Rings technology or the guy that plays Avon Barksdale from The Wire plays an aging basketball, like this is like he's a guy on his last feet. He wants to do like one last
championship. Me as super tall, but he was standing next to Idris Elba,
right?
And that's most of the time, I think is very tall,
right? And if you're, that's the thing, is like if you're like a solid 6'1", 6'2", you can probably carry off being like 6'8". But the guy that plays Kareem, like he has to duck to get under. I don't know whether they're having him stand on stilts or what, but he's incredible.
And they're also freaking tall too. Bird is much taller than even a tall normal person. So.
Right, and he looks lanky, but they also do a really good job, because I've always heard that Kareem is an asshole, but like they show like, yeah, you know, if you're a black man in America going up through this league at this time during the middle of the black power, like it would be hard not to be. I feel a certain way about the game you're playing, with the audience you're playing, and where the money's coming from and how it's being divided. And and this is also a little bit before like the money really got it, because like I think Magic Johnson's playing for like a $500,000 contract, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But like these people are like, they're still relatable as people. Like, you know, Magic Johnson, before he got this money, grew up in a pretty poor neighborhood in Lansing, Michigan. Larry Bird, of course, the hick from French Lick. Like these guys are a lot more, I think, relatable than some of the super duper mega stars of today, because they just like the love of the game seems like it's paramount above all. Yeah, I love it. It's great. This and the Offer they're very great compliments to each other, I think. Jim, I think it's time for us to set a course to Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
This is the return to Star Trek's glory. It's going to be episodic. It's going to be more optimistic. It's not going to be as militarized. It's going to be more cerebral and thoughtful. All right, have they lied to us, or what's Star Trek Strange New Worlds to you?
Yeah, that's definitely the line I was hearing before I saw this show. I watched the first two episodes, which I think is all that's out currently. And I think it was right. I think it's absolutely true. Everything I've seen from these first two episodes feels exactly like the original Star Trek with updated aesthetics. Like I can't determine a difference, honestly.
It's very... like it's miles better than the Star Trek, the old series pilot. It's miles better than the Star Trek, the Next Generation pilot. It's better than the Deep Space Nine pilot. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's an episodic Star Trek. It's not great, like in the way that like maybe the pilot episode of Foundation blew me away, but it is in the class of Star Trek and it felt like Star Trek.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is Kiva Goldsman, Alec Kurtzman, and Ginny Lumet have been the ones responsible for ruining modern Star Trek. So there's two things I want to say. I have liked the first two episodes of every season of Star Trek Picard I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so. these people are still at the helm. The only thing we're banking on is the episodic nature. It's episodic nature is going to keep them from making season long turds and can like just have them always doing the beginnings and ends of things, which they excel at.
Yeah. And from what I saw of the season so far, those two episodes are not connected in any real way. The only thread I could possibly see running through this is some kind of trauma with Pike, right? Like
it's a premonition.
Something happened. He saw a premonition of his own death, essentially, and it was heroic, right? He like saved all these people during it, but like, how's that going to affect him as a captain?
Because he's going to be beef jerky in a wheelchair after that incident.
But that's literally the only thread that I can see, and I'm glad for that because, like you said, they haven't done a good job keeping multi-thread seasons going. So let's go back to this episodic thing, and I really enjoyed these first two episodes.
I
don't know what's better because I recently watched all of Star Trek Continues, which is this like fan-made continuation of the 5-year mission of the original series, and I really loved that. I thought they nailed the essential qualities of the original series. This is doing that too, and I honestly couldn't tell you which is better at this point. It's a much lower budget on Star Trek Continues. It doesn't look as good. It's trying to emulate the aesthetics of that original series, so it all looks cheesy and shitty, but that's kind of great. But this looks good in a different way, so...
Yeah, I really liked... I thought the artistic direction of this show is stunning because they're taking the lines and design elements of this class, like this kind of retro future 1960s spaceship look, but they're like rendering it with all the care and the art that the 20s... Like everything is chrome and reflective and like the nacelles are really... Like they're classic, but they're doing glowing LED things that make them look... fresh. The bridge is exactly the Enterprise, but it looks like you know, instead of these like carved wooden button, I don't know, it's like it looks still futuristic, but also recognizably the old series era and technology. Hats off to how they've split that.
I am torn a little bit on the aesthetics here because I think like They're still very much leaning into that J.J. Abrams lens flares constantly. Like there's, you can't escape the lighting in this show. it never feels like a scene is lit in a way that's just supposed to kind of sink into the background. It always feels like you need to notice this lighting. And I hate the way that it's just completely unusable the way that they've done the bridge consoles where you have light shining in your face. Like as a streamer, as somebody who does live shows, lights in your face constantly wears on you and it will be a huge problem. And yet these consoles just have light shining right up in your face. Big bar lights, right? It's not like, oh, the buttons are lit. No, there are huge LED glowing sconces. They're just burning holes in your eyes. I hate that. I think it's stupid. It shows that they didn't put that much thought into this, but also I actually really like that the bridge is lighter than what we've seen in modern Trek because it's more like, you know, the Enterprise in the Star Trek movies, right? It's very much a light color. It's not like La Serena and Picard, which is all dark and sinister looking.
Moody,
for a Federation ship. What is this?
Yeah.
Or the Stargazer especially. Like,
yeah.
That kind of stuff was crazy.
Borg-derived technology, Jim. You got to understand.
Yeah. So I am mostly liking the aesthetic. I think it looks great, except for the lighting in some places. But yeah, I'm very pleased with it. I thought episode one, you know, they get into a lot of that Pike trauma stuff, right? And that's kind of like the crux of it. He's got to go back to a mission to save his old number one from a planet that she never should have got captured on. And so they go through that. And episode two is very different. It's more of like, you know, that Keurig episode of Star Trek The Next Generation?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's a lot like that, actually. There's a threat in orbit that is going to wipe out a planet, and they need to deal with it, but there's something preventing them from dealing with it.
Because Wesley tripped into the roses. God damn it.
Yeah, exactly. That feels very Star Trek to me. I really enjoy it.
I wasn't sure about Spock's baby mama drama, like the sexy bonfire that was interrupted by the 7-year mission.
Spock sounds so much like Lee Pace in like later seasons of Halt and Catch Fire. Like,
interesting.
Exactly like Lee Pace sounds. It's wild.
I really liked a security officer who I thought for a minute was Cara Gee, like, because she looks so much like Drummer in a Starfleet uniform.
Yeah,
and I noticed her last name was the same as Khan from Wrath of Khan fame.
Oh.
And they alluded to something about her history with those. So I think it's kind of fascinating to like an offshoot clone or a cousin or a niece of his is serving Starfleet.
Yeah, because there's like stuff like that in Picard as well.
That's right.
Interesting.
They're definitely tied, because like Disco is mentioned several times as being the crisis that embroiled the first officer. It looks like they are kind of like being self-referential, which is smart. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, like I'm excited to see like another kind of super strong mental or what a super strong mentally superior, but with a checkered past, or I guess checkered past by relation, what that's going to look like.
And I kind of like the way they're spinning, you know, Star Trek type plots, because like this concept of a warp bomb in the first episode is actually pretty cool, and I've never seen it really used that way. So they're putting a little bit of care and thought into the plots for these episodes. The inciting event, like what is the thing here that's going to be the turning point of the episode.
Yeah.
And that was cool.
I also like they're kind of poking fun at their own like struggles of internal canon, because in the Christopher Pike episode, the Prime Directive is referred to as General Order Number One.
They have this big test
of the General Order, and then they're like to emphasize that they've changed. That'll never stick. I like when Star Trek has fun with its own, you know, loose canon.
You mentioned all the people who have ruined Star Trek over these last 10 years or whatever. I'm going to add one more name to that list. And I know you don't agree. I know most people probably don't agree. But Jeff Russo, man, your themes just aren't hitting me like I want them to. Like, give me a fucking melody that doesn't get mired down in a bunch of over-the-top drums and tinkles from your fucking percussion section. Don't make me look for the melody. Hit me with it. Fucking hit me with it like the old Star Treks did. That's what I want. And Jeff Russo,
you know what,
refuses to deliver one of those.
I'll agree. I don't know that he's the person ruining Star Trek, but I could not hum Picard or Disco's intro if you asked me to.
Right?
And I've seen all of the Star Treks of Picard of my youth had very distinctive... and you can get like, you can gussy that shit up like they did in like Star Trek 2 and 3 with bells and cymbals and all kinds of shit. But like, you got to have like something to hang your hat on. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So I don't know. The intro has like the original narration, right? It's just 100% the same. Mm-hmm. It's just Christopher Pike. It's Anson Mount or whoever reading it.
I don't think that was in the pilot, because I don't remember that being the case. Or maybe I wouldn't skip the intro.
I thought it was.
Here you go. The Bald Move hosts are in agreement. Some of this new Star Trek in you amulet is good. It's pretty good. I look forward to it. Yeah. The nacelles popping off and it losing life support in the coming weeks. But hell, I don't know. Maybe this episodic stuff is their, what's the opposite of kryptonite? Their strength, their yellow sun that they derive sustenance from.
Could be. I have to say one thing. I know we want to get on to other things, but One more thing, because I watched The Offer and Star Trek Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus on my PS4. Where are you watching this?
Paramount Plus on my television set, the Disney native app.
Is that native app any good? Because the one on PS4 is a true piece of shit. Like, I thought Disney Plus was bad when it launched. Disney Plus was capable of playing an episode. This is not. This straight up cannot play episodes. If I pause an episode in the middle of it, it won't resume. It just will not play. It will kick me back out and say it couldn't continue the episode. If I try and then, you know, the bars on the screenshots that show you how far you are into the episode to resume it. If I then try and resume, it starts the fucking episode over again. Tyler Perry gets onto the fucking screen at least four times while I was trying to watch episode two, because I stopped at the 38 minute mark to pause to have a conversation with my wife. Guess fucking what? On The Offer, I had to go find another way to watch these things, because the Paramount Plus app is fucking awful.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Like, it's one of those things where their next on is just going to launch you to the next episode, and if it's you're far enough into that episode, it's just going to consider it watched. Or
No. This will not resume.
It's that. I haven't had that, but I'm saying, like, there's multiple issues. The fact that you can't skip their mandatory commercials at the beginning,
dude.
The fact that you can't skip intros, like, it's pretty rudimentary. The fact that, like, from the first screen, you can't just go to a show's launch page to browse what episode and season you want to go. It's just like, watch just this episode, and you got to X out of it and go through three clicks to get to what you really want. Yeah.
I thought Disney was bad. This is god awful. I've never seen a player this bad, period. The fast forward rewind functions don't show you a screenshot, so you have no idea what you're, like, what part of the show you're in. They won't go faster than, like, 3x. So fast forwarding to, because it won't resume, right? So what you got to do is you got to try and fast forward. So I had this cycle where I paused it to have a conversation with my wife 38 minutes into an episode of The Offer. And I'm like, okay, I'll just hit play to resume where I'm at, because I'm still in the episode. It still shows me the screen.
Sure. Yeah.
It wouldn't do it. And it eventually kicked me out to the main menu. It showed me the bar that I was 38 minutes in. So I'm like, okay, now I'll resume. Tyler Perry comes up and tells me about some shit I don't care about for the third time, because I've watched the episode before.
Yeah, not being able to skip that and promotional then it won't, stuff.
It starts over, and then I try and fast forward. I fast forward it for 5 minutes. I fast forward this fucking thing to get to the 38 minute mark. I hit the play button. Guess what fucking happens? Can't play. Kick back out to the main menu. Now it doesn't even show the bar for 38 minutes. It's like I never watched the episode. As a matter of fact, it's like I never watched any episode. It's fucked to a point where I can't believe it was released. It's so bad. It makes me want to unsubscribe from Paramount Plus. It's so fucking bad.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
I need to watch it on something else, apparently, because PS4 is just broken.
I will say, like, I haven't seen any of that stuff, but it might be because I can't recall. I know I paused because we got dinner, or that someone delivered food to us in the middle of an episode of The Offer. But I don't know that I've ever rewound either of these shows. I just kind of watched them as they went. I was annoyed at the stuff I couldn't fast forward through or couldn't automatically skip. But a lot of people need to improve a lot of things about a lot of players. There's very few of the people that kind of has it down cold. I want to talk about Atlanta on FX. Okay. You have watched the first season. Have you seen all of it?
I've seen 6 episodes the first season, and I thought it was great.
Okay. Because, man, this show continues to evolve. This thing has continued to be have Donald Glover's actual face in it less than half the episodes. I think we're on like a three episode stretch of not having the main cast in them. But
weird,
these are still very hilarious episodes, and they're also exploring some of the frontiers of race relations in America. And I thought it was interesting because recently I was with a group of people, and we were talking about people of, I would say, that, like, mostly of my political bent. You know, we were having conversations about Ukraine. We're having conversations about inflation. We're having conversations about, you know, just so I got a general pulse of, like, the type of, and we're doing the thing. I was like, well, have you seen this? Oh, I want to see this. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it? Oh, I've heard it's so good, but I haven't seen it yet. You're doing that kind of thing. That's like now what you do at parties instead of actually everyone watching the show that everyone's watching. And someone mentioned Atlanta and somebody like kind of got a wrinkle in their face. Like, oh, I heard that show gets political. And we were just talking about a bunch of insanely political things. And I forget what show we were talking about before it was And I'm like,
Star Trek Strange New Worlds, maybe?
No, I'm like, man.
There's a whole shitstorm about that. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Like, people, like, if black folk try to tell you the way they feel about a certain thing, it's political.
Right.
But it is like, I will say that this show, and that, I would never recommend a conservative or even a centrist friend to watch this show and be like, oh, you should see. Because like, I feel like this show more than any other I've seen in like general mainstream pop culture is just really, doesn't regard like the white, gaze or point of view. Mm-hmm. Like, but it's also extremely sympathetic. Like there's an episode that explores like what would happen. What if reparations, like it's almost like a Black Mirror episode where it starts off with this white guy and he's listening to NPR and taking his kid to school and he's meeting with his wife and he's just a normal dude. He's like upper middle class. He's a programmer and his wife's a lawyer or something. And the Supreme Court recognizes one descendant of a slave who is traced back who owned her ancestors. And Supreme Court's allowed them to sue for the lost labor. And this black lady shows up on his front yard and is like, I want to get your house. You, Mr. Blah, 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 your great grandfather owned my mom. And I'm going to, and she's, and like his wife, who is a white lady, but her last name is like Estevez or something, that you see like her text him, like, oh, we need to talk. And you can see her emojis up until the point for his history were just like the regular yellow emoji. And the emoji she uses to talk to him there was a brown emoji. Because she doesn't want to be associated with it. So, and it kind of like does like this 360 of like, well, what would it feel? And like the inescapable conclusion of the episode is that would be kind of unfair. But how fair has life been? And who has it been fair to? And what would be the logical outcome if you did put this system into place?
So it sounds like this is a conversation about
the
topic, not something that's like preaching.
Right. But a bunch of white people would not get past the first 15 minutes of the episode where this guy's life just gets, unjustly uprooted because of something that he had no control of and didn't even have any knowledge of up until, kind of recently. There's an episode where they had this kid who is has a black dad, not an adoptive father, a black kid dad, but through the combination of genetics, he comes out passing white. He's got straight hair, I think blue eyes. They film it in black and white, so you can't like kind of judge his complexion. And at his high school, like they show that his father's black and he's a working class guy. And he's like, are you going to fill out these scholarship forms? He's like, I ain't filling out shit. I ain't co-signing shit. If you want in this fancy ass college that all your friends are going to, you're going to have to pay for it yourself. And they go to school that day. And the speaker, they're renaming their high school from Robert E. Lee, who's, of course, the Civil War general, to Robert S. Lee, who happens to be a former black graduate who is now a billionaire. And he comes back and he gives a speech. And at the end of it, he goes, I'm going to pay for every student's tuition to whatever college that they want. And everyone starts celebrating. He goes, who's black? And then you see like all the white kids go like, oh, and all the black kids are like, fuck yeah. And then this kid's like, I don't know how I should feel. Mm-hmm. And this guy, this billionaire gets this tribunal who looks like it's got CeeLo Green and another black guy on it. And they like judge this kid about whether he's black enough to.
Black Mirror of the race.
Yeah, like
world,
White Mirror.
Right?
It's White Mirror.
What I mean. It's like the conversations about these topics that are sticky.
Yeah, and like, so it's like Twilight Zone or Star Trek. It's like, totally, So this kid, he gets found like he's not black enough to be considered black for purposes.
Wow.
So he comes, and so he comes to go, he builds a homemade flamethrower at home, and he comes to school to burn it down.
Oh, Jesus.
And as he's walking down the sidewalk to the leads, he comes to another kid that's black, like, you know, dark black. Mm-hmm. And he's a Kenyan who just immigrated, and his dad and mom are a doctor. And he's like, he looks black, but he doesn't have the black experience. And he was also found by this guy to be not black enough.
Hmm.
So it's like, it's just like this, like there's really interesting conversations about what it means to be black and the intersection of whiteness. And like I said, it still managed to be empathetic to, I guess, the white sensibilities of people who are watching it. But it's one of those things where it's like, I feel like if you showed the average person who's like conservative or even moderate, they would be angry at much of the content in this episode and not mm-hmm. stick with it enough to get. So I feel like the best way to use this is to look at these interests, these things, and try to, like, if I was trying to explain some of the stuff to like family, I wouldn't say like, go watch this episode, Atlanta. It'd be like, how can I, using my own personal experiences, build the analogies and the perspectives to where a person like that might enjoy this show? Because I feel like that's what Donald Glover's doing. He's taken his experiences, because he's kind of been one of those guys who was caught between, like, you know, when he started rapping, a lot of people were like, you're not black enough, you don't talk black enough, you haven't been in black roles. Aren't you the rich kid son of Danny Glover, kind of like all, and he's got just a huge talented pool of writers around him, and they're bringing all these experiences to kind of help people understand, but they don't go that last mile to break it down to like, just, you know, you have to have like some kind of like 101 understanding of the conversation. But if you do, and again, mm-hmm. it's just fucking hilarious. Like the Trivial Pursuits game of if this kid is black enough that they play with this kid is, on the face of it, just hilarious. Like it's just the questions they're asking. I don't know. I'm very impressed by how the show has so far transformed outside of what it was in the beginning.
Oh yeah,
but still managed
unrecognizable,
to be,
man.
Yeah, like I said,
it was just like a character drama kind of thing set in, you know, the black worlds, but like
in the fictional black experience. No, it's great. I can't tell what I like better, the ones that are still about Earn and Paperboy, or the ones that are like these just kind of like, Twilight Zone episodes, but for like white people to experience, you know? Anyway, I think there's only one episode left.
Just start a new show. What is it? Why do you think he did this with Atlanta instead of starting a show like White Mirror or something? It's like tailored to that.
I wonder if this is just one of the more creative solutions to COVID that we've ever seen. Like,
could be.
there's you know, we've got these mega famous people now. It's hard to get them together in the first place. You also got COVID restrictions. We're filming over in Europe. Like, that was a big ask as part of the main, because the main line is essentially of the canonical stuff that's happening in Atlanta is like the Atlanta cast experiencing blackness through the lens of Europe and a European tour.
Oh, okay.
Which is also interesting, but like that's probably expensive and tough to pull off. So it's like, this is just a way to make the COVID restrictions and budget, which again, bravo, because the other thing is the cinematography in this season is incredible. There's this director, Hiro Murai, who I've never heard of before, is like shot all but one of these. Donald Glover directed the last two that I saw. He's just got like some kind of fucking eye. These things look like A24 projects, but also they still deliver at least one gut busting laugh per episode. And it's kind of funny because it's got all this super serious edifice and tone and theme and information, and then they just hit you with like one of all time best physical gags or just sight gags or whatever. It's really funny. I recommend it if you want your concepts of whiteness and blackness challenged. It's pretty damn good. What else? I think that's it. Jeez, that's a lot of stuff that we watched.
Yeah, I've been watching a bunch of TV. I watched a couple movies too, but
Oh, I did too. I rewatched all of the Hunger Games.
Ah, Jesus.
Because I'd never seen the last one, and we watched the riff tracks, and it was so funny, and we're like, yeah, it's a silly franchise. What did you get sucked into?
I watched Molly's Game and what is the name of that? Don't Breathe. Don't Breathe.
Oh, that's
the horror movie about kids who break into a blind guy's house and get trapped in there with him.
Is the blind guy like evil, or does he have a perspective by the end of it? Because I wasn't sure like about that hook of like, this guy's clearly the yeah. antagonist, but he's just a black guy in his home. Or no, not black guy, a blind guy in his home.
Blind war vet too. Let's just say you're not sympathetic to him by the end of that movie.
Okay. All right. He's one of those mean disabled Americans.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
Okay.
I feel like I'm in the clear saying yes, he's a real asshole.
He's a piece of shit, that guy.
And Molly's Game, not my favorite Sorkin work, but it was fine. I like the poker parts. Everything else, eh.
Mm. All right. Well, yeah,
Jessica Chastain is great.
Hunger Games, they should have stopped at one. And Jennifer Lawrence is kind of amazing. But there's only so much she can do, man.
Yeah.
All right. I think that'll be it for Off the Clock. I hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back with more updates about The Offer. More, because I think they're going to do two a week from here on out on Paramount.
Oh, are they? That's great, because I can't get enough of that show.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about this with David Chin later this week when we have him on for Empire Business. But like, there's room for blended approach. I like a 3-2-2-2. That's a pretty good pace for a season to cut. I hate the 10-0. Because that seems to destroy the community and the discussion around it. But like, if anything, you know, making the pace a little bit more arbitrary to suit the show, then, you know, I think that's the way to go.
You think at the end of the season, so there are 10 episodes? You think they'll do mm-hmm. 3, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, whatever, 3?
Ooh, maybe one.
Or one,
I don't know.
At the end.
They'll probably, maybe they do one for the, like, the finale.
Yeah.
I have no fucking clue, dude. Or maybe they'll go back to doing one now from here on, because like, it's Paramount Plus. They could do anything. Who knows what they can do? They can do anything.
Except make a good PS4
capable
app.
Of anything, except for making a good PS4 app. We'll be back in a couple weeks to talk about more Barry, more Atlanta, more The Offer, more of ever. Because like, there's Shining Girls that I didn't get around. Right. I'm still, Pachinko's on my list to catch back up on. So
TV
and things
is
are
coming
about to
back
get busy
in a very real way also.
Yeah.
For like football move coverage too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's crazy stuff coming out. Yeah. So thank you for your support. We hope you found this informative and entertaining, and we'll see you back on the next one. Later.